This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm talking to Brad Meltzer. He's the author of a new book called The Fifth Assassin. It's a great novel, and really glad to talk to you, Brad. How are you?
Thanks, David. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Well, so, you know, because this book has such an intricate plot, it's really, in some ways, more difficult to talk about than some books because, you know, plot is really important to this book, but we don't want to talk about it too much. So we're going to talk around some of the actual story, but give people a chance to understand a little bit of the background for the book and, where your idea for this novel came from. But in short, it is a book about an assassination plot against a president, not a real one, but an imaginary one, somewhere in the present or near present. And maybe you could talk a little, maybe you should talk about what the fifth assassin means in that context. Where does that come from?
The book actually began a number of years ago, and I've been working for a while trying to figure out how to link the presidential assassins. And because of the kinds of novels I write, conspiracy books, and because of Decoded, which is a TV show I do on the History Channel, no one gets crazier email than me. No one gets sent more proof that Abraham Lincoln is gay than me. I mean, I have a guy who brought me the Holy Grail to one of my book signings. And you know,
purportedly the real Holy Grail.
The real, No. There was no fake Holy Grail. He was like, oh, Brad, you want to see the Holy Grail? I'm like, well, you brought it all the way to the Barnes & Noble. How can I say no? So, but beyond that, sometimes you get a really interesting letter. And I got a letter from a longtime reader who said, Brad, I work in a museum in Washington, D.C. that almost nobody knows about. And you need to come here and see what we have here. And I said to him, well, I'm very, very busy with the Holy Grail, so tell me what you have. And he said to me, well, we have pieces of Abraham Lincoln's skull. We have the bones of John Wilkes Booth. And we have the actual bullet that killed Abraham Lincoln. Do you want to come see it?
Yeah.
And I was like, exactly my reaction. Yeah, I do. And I went there. They didn't just have artifacts from the Lincoln assassination, but they had from some of the other assassinations as well. And it got me thinking, there have been over 24 assassination attempts on the President of the United States. 4 have been successful. And I started thinking, okay, here's the fictional part. What if you had a serial killer who was meticulously recreating the crimes of all the presidential assassins from John Wilkes Booth to Lee Harvey Oswald? And to him, they weren't 4 lone wolves. They were all working together for the same secret cause for over a century. And that's where the fifth assassin begins, is he wants to be the fifth assassin.
And of course, on the other side of the assassin, you have another organization. I wanted to ask you about that. You call it the Culper Ring. I believe that this is based in actual history, that the President George Washington established it. But you know, how much of that is real and how much of that did you make up?
A few years ago, I got a phone call from the Department of Homeland Security, asked me if I would come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And my first thought was, if they're calling me, we have bigger problems than anybody thinks, right? But I was honored to be part of what they call the Red Cell Program. And I went in, and they would pair me with a Secret Service agent and a chemist. And they would give us a target, and we would have to destroy it. I guess they had seen my novels that I do the secret tunnels below the White House, but they asked me to be one of these out-of-the-box thinkers. And as I said, we would destroy a major city in about an hour. And you go home terrified those days. You see how easy it is to kill us. But what I was struck by is, why me? Why did the government, of all the people they could call, pick me, an ordinary person? And I traced it back through history, and it traced back to a man named George Washington. Because George Washington had his own secret spy ring. This is all true during the Revolutionary War, and it was made up of regular, ordinary citizens. And you know why? Because Washington believed that no one will look twice at an ordinary person. And I said to my friend in Homeland Security, wouldn't it be cool if you found out in my next novel that George Washington's spy ring still exists to this very day? And he said to me, what makes you think it doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I got the plot for what became the Inner Circle and then fed into the Fifth Assassin as well. Is finding out that George Washington's spy ring still exists today, and we don't know who they're working for or what they're doing, but the greatest secret of the presidency is about to be revealed. And you see part of that in both the Inner Circle and in the Fifth Assassin.
Right, and in the Fifth Assassin, you make clear that the Culper Ring's job is to protect the presidency, not necessarily the president, but the presidency. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that distinction. What does that mean, and how does this organization operate? You know, it sounds like in the novel, and again, I don't think I'm giving away too much, that they are constantly struggling with forces that actually do know that they exist and are trying to undermine them or kill them off.
Yeah, and you know, and what it was based on was simply that. You know, that very simple concept of George Washington, who saw himself as less important than the role he was playing. George Washington could have been the king of America, right? We won the Revolutionary War. People here were used to a king. He could have said, you know what? Forget, you know, George, I'm the man. I'm the man now. I won. We won. And he could have done that. And the truth is, his popularity, he could have been the king. And instead, he had more faith in us as a country and in us as a people, and said, you know what? It should never be about one person. And so to me, when I had to imagine George Washington's culpering today and his firing today, I could only imagine that it takes care of the presidency, not just the president. Because, you know, to me, it was basically almost a contingency plan by Washington.
So how do you see that connecting to things like the Masons, you know, the Masonic tradition? You know, if you go to Washington, you can go to the Scottish Rite Temple, which is there, you know, and if you have the right connections, you can get a tour, and you find out they have pictures of, or, you know, paintings on the wall of lots of people who were Masons, and it's surprising to find out how many Masons have been in positions of power in the United States. Do you feel there's a connection between that kind of whole tradition of, I don't want to say, well, it is a secret world within the presidency and the power structure, you know, and all of the symbols that are in the, you know, in our money and all the stuff that, you know, Dan Brown has written about as well as you have. You know, how much of that do you feel is sort of alive at all times?
You know, I think all of history is alive. You know, we think that history is this dead old thing, but history changes every single day. When you tell a story of what happened last weekend, you are changing history, right? You're rewriting it as you go. And I think history is this giant game of telephone. I think that the key question is how do you find the first whisper? And to me, when you look at something like the Freemasons, you know, when I was working on the Fifth Assassin, one of the things I found was playing cards. I found a link to a playing card with John Wilkes Booth, and then another link to a playing card with Charles Guiteau, who was the second man to ever kill a president. And now I had this, you know, this is where the fiction takes over, but I had this link to playing cards, hearts and spades and clubs and diamonds. What do those symbols stand for? There have been four assassins, there's four clubs, you know, there's clubs, there's diamonds, there's hearts and there's spades, four suits. And make no mistake, playing cards are symbols, right? They do, it's like the dollar bill, like you said, there's a big giant pyramid with an all-seeing eye on top. It is a symbol. It's not there for decoration. It stands for something. It doesn't mean the Freemasons are out and they're going to kill and eat your babies, but it does stand for something, right? The question is, what does it stand for? And I think in the game of historical telephone that we play every day throughout history, that reality gets lost more and more. So if you're asking me, what do I think, you know, when I look at the Freemasons, you know, mentioned Scottish Rite Temple, you know, Dakota was the third show to ever film inside their inner sanctum there. And you know how we got through, you know what the great secret was? We asked.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's amazing how many people want to write about the Freemasons and tell you they're out to kill you without ever taking 2 seconds to actually talk to one. And everyone loves a good bad guy, but no one wants to ever understand them and see if they really are one. So to me, I think it's alive just out of fear. I think our job, and I take it as my job in the books too, is to kind of educate people and show them, even though we are showing different things and making up, you know, this is fiction, but, you know, showing people some amazing parts of history that truly do get forgotten.
Right, and you did that. I've watched all the Decoded shows. You did that there very well, I thought. You know, that you're showing people amazing truths that are essentially there in front of us at all times, you know, if we want to ask the right questions. And of course, not everybody can go and do the things that you do on that show or do the kind of research that you've done. So it's really great to have you telling these stories, but they're indicative of, well, I mean, they you know, it's not just that they're mysteries, they're also, as the show says, you're decoding, you're telling us what really happened as much as you possibly can, because in some cases, the history is not clear.
Right, and, you know, and that's the, you know, we did an episode on the Statue of Liberty, And if you put in the word Statue of Liberty and Freemason right now, you will get every crazy theory saying that she's a symbol of Satan, and she's the whore of Babylon, all this other nonsense. And to me, the question is not just, oh, you know, is it true? Because I think it's pretty clear to me what it is. But the question is, where does that start? Why is it all over all these websites? Where does that, you know, where does that first whisper begin? And, you know, in that particular example, we found the answer that, you know, there is an answer there. We found it. But what I'm just shocked by is just how many people just want to accept it without ever stopping and saying, what is this really about?
Well, and to go back to the Fifth Assassin, again, without giving away too much, I think, you know, you have these connections, similarities between the four actual assassins that you point out, in, you know, the it, not only in the nature of their lives, you know, that each one was a quiet person you would never have guessed would be an assassin, patient, planning, you know, non-drinking, no drugs. They're really kind of straight up characters. But you also draw other connections between them in the book that kind of connect them to what might be a longer tradition of a secret society, let's say. Now, again, did you base that? I don't know whether you want to talk about that too much because it may give
away. Well, you know, it is worth talking about what they do have in common. You know, one of the things that was amazing beyond that they were, you know, they were all kind of mostly to themselves, or that they, you know, they were all meticulously neat. Every assassin that killed a president, you know, if you look right now and ask the Secret Service, what are the overlaps between assassins? There's no overlap, right? If on attempts to kill the president, there's young people, old people trying to do it, rich people, poor people, there's no pattern. You look at the four who were actually successful, it's amazing what patterns come out. And obviously, it's a smaller group. Of course, it's going to come out a little easier and hardly as scientific. But the four, you know, do have that in common. And when you divide assassins into real categories, beyond being meticulously neat or not doing drugs or barely drinking, here's what they also do is assassins can be divided into two categories, hunters and howlers. And howlers make a lot of noise, and they call in bomb threats. They say they're going to kill us, but the good news is they rarely take action. But hunters are very different. Hunters plot, and they plan, and they kill. And what's fascinating to me is that hunters have almost no interest in howling, and howlers have almost no interest in hunting. And when you look at the presidential assassins from John Wilkes Booth to Lee Harvey Oswald, all four are hunters. And that's amazing to me.
Would you do you put Sirhan in the same category? Even though he was, you know, he's not a killer of an actual sitting president, he does seem to fit that mold a little bit.
Listen, if you want to find like a young, emotionally disturbed man who tries to kill a big shot, like there's easy to put and slot a lot of people in there, from John Hinckley to anyone else you want to put in there. And I feel like, you know, it's not, to be very honest, it's not really fair for me to do that, right? Because then I'm just using the things that prove my theory and my hypothesis to prove my end result. But no question, listen, look around at the shootings right now. And, you know, when we look at Colorado or what happened in Arizona, or you look at these shootings, you show me a 20-something young narcissist who thinks that violence is the cause. That's not something that just is happening now, today, in the 21st century. That's a creation that's been haunting us as a country for over a century and a half. And that's what's scary to me, is that we see this pattern over and over again. And then we tend to kind of wring our hands at the moment and say, how did we get here? And we forget that we've been here for a long time.
So do you think about what it might be that causes that tendency in that particular group? I'm curious if you have thoughts about that.
I think when you look at like a 20-year-old, just very honestly, I think you see, think of yourself in your 20s. It's the moment in your life where you think you could do anything, and you do think the world revolves around you. So I'm truly not surprised when I see that some 20-year-old takes that to the wrong level. I mean, I know it sounds silly, but, you know, that is just a fact of kind of that age and that ego at that moment. But in terms of stopping them, you know, there was a science convention, a scientist convention a number of years ago, where they asked these futurists, what will the greatest threat to the U.S. government be in the future? Predict it. You know, and it used to be obviously nuclear war or fights with, you know, battles with the Russians or war there. And it wasn't about, you know, North Korea, and it wasn't about China, and it wasn't about Russians, it wasn't about anything. What they said the greatest threat will be to the next decade to two decades in the United States The greatest threat to United States security is simply this: an individual or small group who is willing to die for a cause. And you don't need to evoke anything more than 9/11 to realize how scary and how true that is. So if you want to stop it, you know, obviously you have to deal with issues like that. But at the end of the day, you know, it really is just going after you know, one or two people. And that's a really hard thing in a country of millions.
Right. It's a hard thing in any place, because it's
sure.
It is the proverbial needle in a haystack, and very difficult to guard against because you don't know who that person could be. It's you know, it's difficult. Well, I want to switch gears just a little bit and talk to you a little bit about you know how you became a writer, and where does this book fit in your you know, kind of the arc of your career, and where you see your writing going. What prompted you to write your first book?
You know, for me, I grew up. I went to the University of Michigan. Was one of the first in my family to attend college. And always felt very lucky that I got to do what I do. But I came out, and a guy who worked in Boston named Eli Siegel said to me, "I'm going to be your mentor. I'm going to teach you all the great things about business. And I'm going to, don't go to law school," he told me. He said, "Stay here." And I moved all my stuff to Boston, moved everything to Boston. And the week I got to Boston, he left the job. And I said, "Oh my gosh, what do I do now? You know, what do I possibly do? I've wrecked my life." And so what do any of us do when we think we wrecked our lives? I said, "I'm going to write a novel."
Well, not everybody
right.
feels that
Isn't
way.
Everybody, right? That's what we would all do in that situation, right? Any logical person would think that is the option. And the truth was, I didn't know what I was doing. But every day that I sat down to write, I loved talking to these imaginary people even more. And my first book, I will tell you, got me 24 rejection letters. To be clear, there were only 20 publishers at the time. I got 24 rejection letters, which means some people were writing me twice to make sure I got the point. But I said, if they don't like that book, I'm going to write another. And if they don't like that book, I'm going to write another. And that was the start of my writing process, was just slowly falling in love with talking to these imaginary friends. And the week after I got my 23rd and 24th rejection letter is the week that I started the 10th Justice.
And how long did that take you to write?
You know, all the books take me about the same time, which is about 2 years to write. You know, when I started, I was like, "Oh, I did it in 2 years," and I was writing it in law school, literally in law school and on weekends. And when I finally could do it full time, I said, "Oh yeah, you know, now it's going to be totally different. I'm going to have so much time because I do it full time," and it still took me the same 2 years. It's how it is. I wish I could say I get faster, but I get slower.
You do a lot of research for each book.
I do. It takes me at least minimum 6 months worth of research just to kind of figure out where, you know, where the book is going to be and what we're going to do. But to me, that's the fun of the process. I really love that part of it. I don't, you know, I guess I could write a book every year, but, and God bless the guys who could do it every year and it's great. But if I did it every year, it would be churned out garbage. And I never, ever wanted to put that out there.
Well, in some ways, you know, you're writing, you are so involved in history, and of course, this coincides with your interest in the materials in Decoded. Have you thought about? I mean, what drives you to continue to write fictional history in a fictional form, which is different, of course, from writing pure history, factual history? Have you ever been interested in, going in the other direction, you know, becoming more of a popular historian in your writing? And I don't mean replacing the fiction, but maybe.
Yeah, no. And trust me, you know, when I did Heroes for My Son and Heroes for My Daughter, these were books I wrote for my kids that were 60 heroes, from Amelia Earhart to Rosa Parks to Abraham Lincoln to Jim Henson to Mr. Rogers. And I got to write real nonfiction there. It was real research. Here it is, one-page stories of greatness. You know, the Wright brothers' story said that when the Wright brothers, every time they go out to fly their plane, they bring enough extra materials for multiple crashes, which means every time they went out, they knew they would fail. And they would crash and rebuild and crash and rebuild, and that's why they took off. And I was like, I love that story. And so I love telling and sharing those stories in Heroes for My Son and Heroes for My Daughter, but the truth is there's nothing like the house I built with my own hands. And that, for me, is the novel. So those are the, you know, I may have my editor who keeps me from really driving the bus off the cliff, but I really like that that I get to do, you know, really build that house with my own hands.
Sorry, will you continue this series? So will there be another book that has this character Beecher, who now is really, you know, by the end of The Fifth Assassin, he's become much more fully formed and is kind of, you know, he's the guy now. Is he going to continue?
Yeah, no, Beecher's here to stay. I really like him as a character, and I feel like I'm not done telling his story, to be honest. I feel like it's definitely just one of those ones that I'm still learning and getting adjusted to, and I don't mind that for one bit. I love that.
So do you have an idea for what will happen next, or are you just too busy now, you know, kind of in the moment of The Fifth Assassin being published, where you have to work on, you know, the promotion and selling of this book? Is it hard to think about the next book, or impossible?
You know, I slowly get my brain around it. But the truth is, I have a lot of research ahead of me. I mean, I know where the characters are going. I know what they're doing. I know a lot of it, but I certainly, I can't possibly say that I know all of it.
So are you able to say what the research, where you're going to go?
Nope. I never talk about it until I'm done. Someone once told me they talked about a book before it was done, and then it screwed the whole thing up. So I always feel like that's good advice.
Well, it probably is. I think even as I asked, I thought, oh, that's really a bad question to ask, because you really don't want to, you know, first of all, things could change so much.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, every time you start a book, whatever you plan for, your life takes over. When I finished the first draft, you know, listen, there's all the things you plan to put in a book. And when I finished the first draft of The Fifth Assassin, I basically was like, okay, what did I put in here that I didn't realize I was putting in here? And when I looked at that, I said, what is Beecher doing here? And I said, oh, he's growing up. Of course, that's what Beecher's doing. This is the first book I'm writing since the death of my parents. My character has no choice but to grow up. That's what I was doing in my real life.
Right.
And there's
always a connection, isn't there?
Well, you know, that's the thing is, you show me a novel and I'll show you what the novelist is dealing with in their life, at least an honest one. And to me, that was a vital one to me, is really trying to focus on that.
Yeah. No, I've said this before to other writers that in a writing class that I took in college from a guy who's now, you know, pretty well-known writer, one of his points was that if you look carefully at almost any novel, what you're going to see is the problem that the writer was wrestling with that the book indirectly addresses, explains, resolves, or sometimes doesn't resolve, but deals with.
I always say that my novels are just, you know, things that saved me from my own therapy.
Right. Well, so you'll have to wait to see what the next phase of your life is.
My own problems are.
Exactly, right. Or you may not know. I mean, you know, in that way, the book can be, I don't want to say book writing is therapy, but, you know, those characters they are telling you something.
Oh, they are. If you listen to them, you know, there's no better moment in writing when you stop telling the character what they're supposed to be doing and they start telling you what they want to do. And when you hit that moment, if you hit that moment, it's just magic.
Right. Well, I think I've heard that from writers before in different ways, but I think what you just said is really profound. I think, you know, there is magic there, and I bet for a lot of writers, if the magic doesn't happen, then the book isn't really going to be as good.
Yeah. I think, you know, the thing is in the beginning, I think that, when you write your first book, people always say, oh, I love the first book. The first one's my favorite. It's like, that's why the writer isn't conscious of what they're putting in. They're just putting in, they don't realize. You know, it's just like they're just using every ingredient they have, and the best ingredient of all is their soul. That's what you put in it. And then when the book comes out, you realize what you've revealed about yourself, and that's why there's never a book like your first book, because you're like, oh my gosh.
Yes.
Now
yes.
I got to be guarded. People noticed that. People picked that up. People saw that. And it's a really terrifying moment. But to me, the only way to get better as a writer is to jump into that fear and try on that entirely different skin and put yourself out there and be comfortable. I mean, if you took a look at an early interview that I do, when my first novel came out, I'll be the first to say they were terrifying. I mean, I just give baseball quotes and say everything's good and everything's great and isn't it wonderful? I'm so happy to be here. And it's wonderful like that, and it's all true. But the truth was, I was terrified that anyone should see a chink in any piece of me. And now I realize that's the best part of being a writer, is to express yourself, is to use that creativity to help yourself, help others, help anyone in between. And I feel like I write my best stuff when I can be honest.
Yeah, no, that's, I think that's a really good thing to know, but I think it's also, as you said, it's harder in some ways because you know more, and yet it's better because you know more. So you have both things going on at the same time.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. The thing is, the more honest you're willing to be, and the more you're willing to put yourself out there, the better off you're going to be.
Oh, I think that's really good. Well, I listen, I know you have other things to do, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me today. So I'm going to let you go now, but thank you so much, Brad. Really, lo I love this book. It was really fun. It is, as they say, a page turner, in the most obvious way. You can't stop reading it once you start. So I thought it was terrific.
I very much appreciate it.
Thanks, Brad. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Brad Meltzer about The Fifth Assassin. Thanks so much.